Welcome back to Tasteland. I am Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto, and I did not book a guest for this week.
That's okay. You're not supposed to tell them that. You know, you can keep the fourth wall up. We're breaking it here. Today we're talking to each other.
Yeah, we needed to catch up, so why not do it on the record?
Mm-hmm. It's been a while since we did one of these.
I know. I think we did one right before the holidays, which feels like 5 years ago. So,
yeah, that was 5 years ago.
We've had several weeks where everything, decades happened since.
Several weeks. So. This has really been a week where decades happen. We don't really need to get into the geopolitical events. I don't think that's what people come to Tasteland for. And I don't.
Also, I'm really glad that Ryan at Garbage Day, he has a good take on monitoring the situation. I'm kind of done hearing that phrase. So
monitoring the situation. Monitoring situation monitors. Wasn't it?
Who will monitor the situation monitors?
Reggie, wasn't he vibe coding some situation monitoring app a few weeks ago? He did.
I'm going to ask him about it. I think it broke. It was overwhelmed by
too many situations.
No, I'll ask him about it. I'm actually talking to him tomorrow.
Some of you need to stop monitoring the situation and situate yourself in front of a monitor and get some work done.
Some of you need to monitor your situationship. eyes on your own home.
I'm going to stop it there.
It starts in the home.
It starts in the home. Situations.
They start in the home. I myself have been in several situations. My own home this week.
Today even?
Is as late as an hour ago.
Was it the exterminator breaking into your house again?
No, that hasn't happened in a while. I think I scared him sufficiently last time.
Mm-hmm. Realized he was never going to exterminate you.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, let's talk about something. So I
haven't seen the mouse in a while, though.
You haven't seen the mouse?
Yeah, I know you guys were wondering about that.
Yeah, mouse has seen you, I can tell you that.
I actually think I repaired the hole that the mouse was coming through. I don't want to give myself too much credit, but I think I found.
How did you repair the hole that the mouse was coming? Did you?
With some spray foam.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice. Anyways, I want to talk about Caper, the new food media company. I profiled them for Creator Spotlight, published today as we record yesterday. As you listen to this, listener, if you listen to this the day it comes out.
I think most people do. I think most people can't wait and structure their week around it.
I would agree. Mm-hmm. No, okay. Well, I want to start, though, not just Caper, but a conversation I was having with Emma Orlo, one of the founding journalists, when I interviewed her last week. I think it was too much context and too little about Caper for that conversation. But we've brought this up before. About a year ago, I remember when Eater critic Robert Sietsema was laid off. Emma said she was there for 4 years, and she said she remembers around 5 layoffs in the 4 years she was there. And this was one of them, right? This was December.
That'll really spike your cortisol, huh?
Yeah, yeah. This was December.
Getting layoff mogged by your employer.
Layoff mog, getting logged. I mean,
everyone just shut this off. Not only are we using Gen Z slang, it's like stale from 3 weeks ago.
It's not
how embarrassing you guys.
Behind. Yeah. Well, anyways, I'm gonna topic mog you and keep this going.
Okay.
But we did talk about this a little over a year ago. Robert Sietsema was laid off, and then I noticed New York food influencer Food Baby NY. He then got his first byline. It was like Food Baby's best slices of cake in New York City. And, you know, that seemed like no coincidence that a food creator was getting a byline right as
also,
their
he's
last
not the food baby. He's
off.
The dad.
He's the dad of the food baby. One thing I'll say, though, this is no shade to Mike Chow, the food baby dad. I think that he does good service journalism work. He's at these new restaurants as soon
as
they open.
He's boots on the ground. Yeah.
He's boots on the ground. He's taking like detailed photos of the food. He's giving you the prices. Like, it is useful service journalism. So the point I was trying to make to Emma when I was talking to her was that maybe creators are becoming the main, most crucial source of this sort of food world or, you know, restaurant service journalism. If these creators are going to go and they're going to take these detailed photos and have these carousels, they are doing service journalism for the audience, as well as marketing, service marketing work for the restaurants, right?
And well, then they're one half of the barbell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about the barbell?
About the barbell. Yeah. Well, okay. So the barbell, on one side, you have the independent creators, and on the other side, you have the institutions. And in the middle, this is how Max Chan, co-founder of Caper, pitched Caper to me. Caper's in the middle of the barbell, right?
Max is squatting the whole thing.
Back to, which, you know, 40 pounds. The bar itself is 40 pounds, you know, so this is no lightweight.
Yeah. Zoran found that out the hard way.
Zoran did find out that out the hard way. I mean, that's an aside, but we could talk about him calm.
Murray Hill guy?
Trump. No.
Also, yeah. Murray Hill guy.
What's up with Murray
the
Hill?
The Trump guys? of Murray Hill. Murray Hill guy, I mean,
I might have.
If anyone knows Twitter or something, this guy's deal, email me. Like, I think his deal is just like, what the hell is this guy's deal? He's kind of a hater. I mean, no, he is a hater. It's allegedly.
I'm surprised,
like,
Nick Cattucci hasn't given him a column in GQ.
There's
yet.
Rumors that the account is run by multiple guys. It's weird, like, incel adjacent, because, like, it's kind of hard to be an incel in New York. You know what I mean? It's like, take that shit.
That's your evolve
elsewhere. Cell. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, he sucks. He think he's a Zoran hater, and he encountered Zoran on a city bike and took a photo and just posted it. And like, Zoran looks great. So I don't know what he was hoping to achieve with that. So I thought that's what you were referencing, but you were actually referencing the president of the United States.
Trump to city, let's build. I thought that was great. Anyways,
it was very clever. I also saw a TikTok that imagined how that was conceived among Zoran's team, which felt a little too meta for me. And I know you and I wanted to get into the meta conversation happening around media that covers media and power right now. Yes. But did you want to
they put a point on what I was saying?
First?
Yes. Yeah. So the point I wanted to make was that, you know, with creators kind of taking up this service journalism torch, I think it's a good thing in that it creates room and demand for this more serious journalism, that, you know, food journalism that's not necessarily about the food, but is about the restaurants, the relationships, power dynamics, et cetera, the kind of thing that Caper is doing. I think this is not just like in food media, but as creators grow more sophisticated and produce a better offering, I think it creates I'm hoping this is like optimistic, right? That it creates a greater demand across niches for more well-funded, well-researched journalism. That's a trend that I would say Caper represents and that I'm hoping we see magnified in various industries more and more.
I think it's...
Because especially as there's so much content to consume, and in any given topic, people are consuming so much content all the time, looking at their phone day in and day out, you inevitably become a prosumer consumer of whatever topics you're following, right? Like, this is why there's that whole thing of, like, Emily Sundberg wrote about this a while ago, right? About
who?
Maybe it was Rachel Carton. I don't know. Substack stars about people commenting on ads being like, the marketing girly slayed this, like, wow, marketing, okay. You know, like, that's because people are spending so much time consuming marketing and they're becoming more fluent in
parts of what marketing CBS is. Contributor Casey Lewis on we her second Tasteland appearance. I think I am skeptical that increasing demand is as simple as increasing supply. I think it's a little bit more complicated.
Well, I've never read Marx or Adam Smith, so I certainly wouldn't know.
Well, but you're saying like that if you have increased supply of service journalism, you can increase the prosumer offering in proportion to that?
Not necessarily. I think that these things are like related, but not like correlation, not causation type of thing.
Yeah. I think it all comes down to demand to pay for it. Like, I'm curious whether Max gave you any insight into what they're expecting to do in terms of their relationship with advertisers.
He did. Yeah, he did. They are planning to work with advertisers. He didn't give me too much that's specific, but the way they're planning to monetize, one will be subscriptions, which he gave me a number that he asked me not to print because they hadn't finalized it yet. There'll be these event series, which I think subscription, if you are a paid subscriber, you will have the ability to buy tickets to these events, but I don't think that you will get, you may or may not get access just by dint of being a subscriber, but one example he gave me, he described it as 8 Mile meets Top Chef. Which is a cooking competition with New York City chefs in rooms that you wouldn't expect. Which, you know, sounds fun. I would
taking place like in Detroit.
No. But, you know, there's that classic scene in 8 Mile that you see clipped in the memes where it's like Eminem's throwing up in the bathroom, mom's spaghetti. Maybe that's just that music video. And it's like, the point is, I guess he's implying it's some sort of like warehouse rave, but it's like Top Chef. You want me to speak on Eminem?
No, I think you should not speak on Eminem.
You think I should? Why is that?
I don't think that you have the expertise.
I'm not
speaking. I think that I know
more I'm about quoting Eminem Max
than you do.
I'm sure you do.
What if we gave Chet Hanks a cooking show?
I would
what
watch
if
it. I would watch
Chet it. Hanks learns how to cook Jamaican food.
Do you think?
Since he already speaks the language.
I would like to see him cook an over easy egg. In fact, perhaps a whole diner breakfast to order.
Well, we have to get him back into the country first.
We have to get him back on the pod first.
I'm monitoring the situation. There's a high-low component of this.
I mean, I guess that's what the 8 Mile thing is. I don't think it was necessarily about high-low. I think it was just about like maybe the low might be the location. I think it was more about, he said rooms you wouldn't expect. And then he said
the G-Train.
The G-Train. On the G-Train.
Subway takes meets cooking competition.
Oh, God.
This is going to come in handy when we all go to prison for our tweets.
Well, it's a good thing. You might go to prison for your tweets. I'm horrible at tweeting, and I tweet like I'm 12 years old again, posting on Facebook in like 2000.
Vague posting? Would you say you're vague posting?
I would say I'm vague potting. But the final piece of the puzzle for the caper revenue, a structure that Max said there's going to be some professional products, business intelligence type of thing. He did not elaborate too much. I think they're still planning that. Even as we speak, that's technically the website's not launched.
You're telling me a business made today, this intelligence?
You tell me. I'm not gonna give a response to that. But that's really all I have to say. I don't know. I think it's cool. I'm probably gonna do a paid subscription. It's exactly the kind of thing I want. I stopped reading Eater around the time that they laid off Seetsima. I used to read it every day. I would open it up, and then it just kind of became uninteresting over time after that. So I don't know. I'm excited to read some well-reported. I've been reading the newsletters already. It's good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the last thing I read in Eater was the big piece they did of like what happened to the foodie. And that was kind of a while ago. So it's not great that I can't remember reading anything in Eater recently.
No. Even like I used to like every Monday morning they would do some little thing like what our editors ate this weekend. Maybe they still do it. I don't know. I guess all the people I followed there just left. And Emma Orlo was probably the last person whose name I really followed there.
I really like Jaya's stuff.
Dirt writer sometimes, right? Am I correct?
Jaya? I don't know if we've had Jaya. I would love to have Jaya. Well, I uncharacteristically have been tracking restaurants that I want to eat at. This is very of me. Well, because my birthday is coming up. And I forgot,
you're a Pisces, aren't you?
I gave Ben a list of restaurants that I was interested in. I don't know. Maybe with this, I also need a new pair of boots. So we'll see what happens. And we have some expenses coming up. But my list was Noon, Nwon.
Is it in Bushwick or is there one in Bushwick and one in the city?
East Village Korean Fusion Spot. You think there's two of them?
There's one off the Jefferson L as well.
That tracks. Have you been to the Snail yet?
No, I've not.
The Snail is on my list. Stissinghouse,
upstate.
Yeah, not that far from me. Well, it's still like an hour drive for us. A harder reservation to get, but because we could go on like a weeknight or whatever, maybe not unattainable. And then this one I crossed off because my best friend wants to go there with me for my birthday. Il Leone, pizzeria that started on Peaks Island off of Portland. And they have a lobster pizza that I really want to try. And they have a new location, like kind of in Park Slope.
Sounds nice. Park Slope. Wow.
Did I tell you I'm going to New Orleans in May?
You didn't. Why are you going?
I'm going to New Orleans in May. My parents had some timeshare points that they were willing to share with us. And so I did like a city search for a few different places. And New Orleans had like a lot of options. And it's Ben's sobriety anniversary, his 10-year sobriety anniversary. So we wanted to do something super special.
So you want to go to New Orleans for that.
Exactly. anyway, if you could be sober in New Orleans, you can be sober anywhere, as That's I true. Say. Shia LaBeouf. Not capable of being sober in New Orleans.
Well, wait. But he is sober in New Orleans, right? This is the thing.
He's high on.
Do you think he broke sob?
Being short, I don't know.
He did say
he broke something.
He broke something. He did say that he thinks he has a small man complex.
Yeah, I know. I agree.
But you should go to Aviva. Go to Aviva.
Okay,
I'll tell you this off pod too. But I'm gonna go. I'm gonna be there and. Few weeks. I'm going to go to Aviva.
Now, this is like probably a bit of a tourist trap situation, but when we were there during COVID, tail end of COVID, the place that's famous for the Bananas Foster, do you remember what it's called?
I think it's Napoleon House. It's one of the old places. I never went to any of the classic old spots when I was there. It's one of those things where I'm like, I'll go to that. It's like I've never been to like Keen's or Peter Luger's in New York, right? The classic steakhouses. It's like I'll go to these places eventually. Like I get it, you know.
Yeah, that's real.
It's like how I've never been
to the Polo Bar.
I've not read Infinite Jest, but I've never read the much more common one, Kurt Vonnegut. I've never read Kurt Vonnegut.
It's like how I've never read Train Dreams.
You've got to read Train Dreams. It's so good.
Then we'll lose that thread on this podcast. We'll have to find a new book to fix
as if we can't afford to lose another thread.
Like lose the thread, but we never lose the plot.
And you sounds like you have to choose between new boots or going to a nice dinner for your birthday.
I hope you don't have to choose because I don't think that my husband would say no to me, but I might force myself to choose based on my own sense of financial propriety.
I bought this book a while ago that's been sitting on my bedside table called The Age of Choice. Have you heard of this?
No.
So it's The Age of Choice, A History of Freedom in Modern Life. This was published last year. I also saw it on the New York Times Best Books of the Year list. Taking readers from the 17th century to today, Sophia Rosenfeld describes how the early modern world witnessed the simultaneous rise of shopping as an activity and religious freedom as a matter of being able to pick one's convictions. Similarly, she traces the history of choice in romantic life.
I hate choices, but I love freedom. Who will speak for me?
Sophia Rosenfeld will, I think. But it's one of these heady nonfiction books that I have stacked in my book. You're not anti-choice?
No.
It sounded like you just
I'm not anti-choice in the abortion sense. I'm anti-choice in the decision fatigue sense.
Yeah, I've oft been a victim of decision fatigue. What's this dirtless essay contest?
We're doing an essay contest with Prism. So they are very cool publication focused on like mental health broadly. And I was having a conversation with them about collaborating, and I told them about the essay contest that we'd done with Lux. And they came up with the theme of the correlation between wealth and health, but like, you know, in a very broad
interpretation. Health is wealth, famously.
Yes. Like how has your relationship with wealth changed? What is your relationship with wealth like? So I hope that we'll get some excellent essays and cultural criticism in addition to the inevitable Marxist screeds. And I'm really excited to read through everything. I enjoyed reading through everything for the Lux contest. And then
what ended up winning?
Like 200 entries for that. So
200, wow.
Yeah, so that was the sweating in the whale costume under the Texas sun essay. I don't know if you remember reading that about... that was Brittany Leitner's essay about her first job at SeaWorld when she was in high school and how that job allowed her to escape poverty, essentially.
Sounds like this one could also win this current contest.
Yeah, there's an interesting overlap. Like the first contest, the emphasis was sort of on work. This one's a little bit more, I guess, on the health side. because of the way that we phrase the call out. And then Jillian Goodman's Making Babies piece about being on the commercial shoot for baby food also won. We had a winner and a runner up from that Lux contest. And the Economic Hardship Reporting Project was an additional partner. So I think it's a good way for us to like find new contributors. And it's really hard. Like if I have submissions default open for DIRT, I get overwhelmed by the amount that people are sending. I feel like contests are a good way for people to be tactical about what they send. And it's easier for me to review everything than just constantly be fielding stuff that's like really great, but maybe not a good fit for us. And then stuff that's clearly written by AI.
That is a good way to do it. We published a few freelance pieces in Creator Spotlight last summer. And I did like a very concentrated, like, hey, we have this pitching window open for this long. And I still today have occasionally gotten, like the last couple months, it's like once or twice a month, I'll get one that is still titled Q3 2025 pitching window. I'm excited to read what comes out of my struggle. Don't say those words on this podcast.
Well,
are you reading anything right now?
No, I'm still kind of working on Gamora. I have a huge backlog of galleys that I've been sent, like stuff that I'm really excited about and just like not getting there. I haven't been in reader mode. Just been working. So sometimes I'm going through periods where I'm doing like a ton of editing and I don't want to use that part of my brain anymore. And that's when I go TV mode. And then I go through long periods where I don't watch TV at all. We haven't even touched on the industry finale.
And I'm only still like two or three episodes in.
So we'll get into it later. But yeah. I mean, maybe a couple episodes from now. I was watching industry and then I started this show on Apple TV. Have you heard of Palm Royale?
Palm Royale is news to me.
I like never heard anyone talk about it. Classic Apple TV. Kristen Wiig.
You know what I do love on Apple TV though is Slow Horses.
Slow Horses is great. We've talked about this before. I don't know if I'm caught up on Slow Horses. I have to check. I definitely watched like the first three seasons.
It was like five or six.
Yeah, I might have stopped after four. I really like Slow Horses. The John Hamm show was like fine.
We got like four or five episodes in and maybe less. Four episodes in and then I never watched anymore.
Yeah, that tracks. Severance, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I watched the first season of Bad Sisters, second season. I was like, you know what? I get it. Speaking of.
Wait.
No, I want to see what you were going to do.
What I was going to do, I was going to talk about what I'm reading very quickly, which is W.G. Sebald's The Rings of Saturn.
Oh, so you just asked me so you could talk about yourself.
Is that so wrong?
No, it's fine. I just think it's interesting.
I talked a little bit about when we had James on the other week. I was reading this book Dahlgren by Samuel Delaney. So I finished that. That was really good. But reading Sebald after that, I was thinking last night as I was reading it, how it's kind of like laptop nonfiction. Shout out to FOTP. God, I can't believe I said that. Shout out to friend of the pod, Greta Rainbow. In that it's ostensibly about Sebald / narrator, you know, a bit of a blur there. No, Nausgaard. Walking around the eastern coast of England, but he'll get distracted in like the history of herring fishing, right? And in that way, specifically when I was reading that segment last night, I'm like, this is the kind of thing where I'm like sitting at my computer thinking about what to write, and then I start writing something. I'm like, oh, herring, like what's up with herring? Let me Google this and then like read four sources and then compile that into whatever essay I'm writing. The other interesting thing about it is there's no paragraphs. Like maybe there's some, but it's kind of hard to read when, you know, you've got just looking at two pages and there's no paragraph breaks. Anyways, it's an entertaining book, but after the very intensely idiosyncratic, colorful stylings of Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren, it's a bit staid.
Would you say it's a bit vague?
I would say, are you, vague queuing? You're specific queuing.
I'm vague queuing. Well, no, I just wanted to see if you had a chance to read Gerst Byron's piece about vague posting in Dirt.fyi.
I did. You know,
you once know you see it, you see it everywhere.
Once you see it,
I think I should have titled it differently.
What was it titled?
Everybody Knows, and then the subhead was like, but nobody wants to say it, or something like that.
Yeah, nobody's so you should have had it. Just that, and then the body should have been completely empty.
It's very avant-garde. I like it. Actually, speaking of avant-garde, submitted something for the first time in a while to my friend Joshua Heburn's call for pieces about repetition, and he name-checked Joe Brainerd, some other of the...
I remember.
Repetition maxers. Sorry. I don't know. I just wonder, it's interesting because, like, in some ways, it's easier than it's ever been to write a script for writing to do something more avant-garde. And I'm thinking about, like, HTML review and some other projects like that, where it's like literature and code really colliding. I was talking about this weekend that, like, the humanities and technology, this is the era of the true collision between humanities and technology, but people forget that the book is among the oldest technologies, as some people would say. And so It's really not a competition between not technology and technology. It's actually a competition between one form of technology and another form of technology. And if I could find a novel way to write about that, I would, but I'm probably just going to keep writing weird prose poems and submitting them because I have to blow off steam.
You gotta blow off steam somehow.
We all do.
Do you know what's up with the New York Review of Finance?
Do I know what's up with it? Yes.
The context I asked this in is that I saw.
I have a voice note from Greta describing the scene at their launch party a few months ago. If you want me to play that for our audience,
I don't know if that would be the best.
Oh, we still haven't done a voice note episode.
Oh, we did talk about doing that. I don't send voice notes. So listener, Daisy is a serial voice noter. I'm not a voice note. My texting style is 10 long or 10, like, you know, short to long texts. I text as I think. It's easier for me to do that than it is to send voice.
I've actually been texting less lately. Mm. I'm down to like 15 people a day instead of 40.
Texting less and going out more.
Exactly. I'll have you know, I was at Charlene's until 3 a.m. this weekend.
3 a.m. this weekend. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll text you next time.
I will exclusively reveal I was still up and looking at my phone when I saw that we had gone to war with Iran.
I was sitting at the bar at Charlene's.
Yeah.
And my friend came back from the bathroom and I said,
hey, by the way,
we bombed Iran.
Yeah.
Not great.
Anyway, the vague posting thing though. Yeah. This, it feels like a new trend, right? Like that you'll see, I guess what's really annoying is the I require context Wojax, which I'll say somebody will post something on Twitter and I won't necessarily get the reference and I will go to the replies thinking,
they're more annoying.
What are they referencing?
Burying the real information. You're so right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You should write something about that.
I should. I need to blow off some steam and write some things.
That, like, I require context guy is like kind of like being like, is there a doctor on the plane? And it's like some guy stands up and he's like, I'm not a doctor. It's like, okay. Like, I'm an electrician.
Okay, well, but see, actually that's really helpful because then you've eliminated at least one person on the plane.
No, I don't know.
See, to me it's really helpful.
I don't believe that you really think that.
No, I don't. Okay, let's talk about 25 years of iPod brain. I really enjoyed, this is another thing published in Dirt quite recently, I think a few days ago, a week ago. But I like this line. I took out this line. It's hard to believe that there was once a time when consumer technology solved problems we actually had. In the late 1900s, one of these problems was the portability of one's music collection.
The phrase late 1900s, my soul left my body when I read that. I was like, that can't be right.
That can't be right. Have you seen these? There's like this meme trend I've seen on Instagram Reels where it's like, it'll be like a sports team. And they're like, when were you born? And they'll say like, 19, and then they don't get to finish it because they go like, it's like the bruh sound or something like that.
I don't watch Reels, but I believe you. Believe Matt.
There but for the curse of the devil.
I've actually been dealing with an ongoing Instagram situation. I can't really post.
Wait. Hold on. Let me monitor this really quickly.
We hit our quota for that. I can't really post on my Instagram story because it has all of my photos that I've given Instagram permission to use out of order. Huh. So if I add a photo,
you don't give it permission for your whole photo roll?
No, and I actually have a conspiracy that this is their way of trying to force me to do that.
Probably, yeah.
But I found some other people on Reddit, as one does, who are having the exact same problem. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe I need this. Maybe this is what I need right now for my Instagram to be kind of unusable.
Yeah. I think that is what you need. I think that any sort of glitch like that is really good.
It's not what dirt needs, though. I'll tell you
that. I'll say this. So I've got my YouTube logged into our home television, and Emma will use it to play, like, you know, 10-hour relaxing music mix, mm-hmm. something like this. And a few months ago, I said, oh, you know, it's kind of annoying that, like, my algorithm on the TV is ruined, which the TV algorithm versus the phone versus the browser algorithm, they're all different. YouTube mm-hmm. tunes them all differently. But I thought, you know, like, sometimes I want to watch something on here and I have to, like, go search for it instead of it being fed here. But I was like in the middle of saying it and I realized, like, oh, I should be thankful that she has flooded my algorithm with relaxation slop, right? Yeah, like, this is so great that there's not an avenue for YouTube to exploit me here. She's cut it off. It's actually a great, great partnership.
What have you been doing to relax recently?
Getting in bed at like 9 to read for an hour and a half before bed.
You've been going to bed earlier?
Yeah.
I've also been trying to wake up earlier.
I feel like I've just been working a lot, and that's like my one
yeah.
thing.
It's like when people say lower your stress, it's like, in what regard? What do you mean?
I rely on my stress. Stress is like how I.
Well, like I'm also like my oil, less stressed when I've worked so hard that I have fewer things to do.
I remember. My first job after college, dishwasher, mm-hmm. prep cook, getting in, and it was, you know, near the end of one of my first shifts, and I asked James, our chef, I was like, is there anything else for me to do or should I go home? And he laughed at me. He's like, well, there's always something else to do. Mm-hmm. And that was when I truly entered the workforce, and there's never been less
when
to
you
do.
You became a man in that moment.
That's when I became a man. Yeah. Yeah.
Ben got to come home from work yesterday early because the heat in the building went out, but he had to finish working from home.
How Dickensian.
Truly. I was like, mm-hmm. they were all in their little coats like the IKEA monkey. Speaking of which, we haven't discussed Punch on this podcast yet, which is shocking.
Discuss.
Ben and I both cried about Punch.
I have to say, I don't know what you're talking about.
The monkey. Punch? The monkey. You've seen him everywhere.
Oh.
His little stuffed mm-hmm. monkey.
Okay, I only know about this from SNL. I did watch
He's
SNL
being
this weekend.
Bullied. He's making progress now with the rest of the monkeys. First time I tried to tell Ben about Punch, I started crying in the middle of my explanation, and I couldn't really like get the words out, and he was so confused. But it must have really affected him because, like, later we were, like, hanging out before bed and he, like, started tearing up and he was like, why would they show us that monkey? If he's so sad. It's really funny. It's also generated a lot of, like, really good meme material. Yeah, I think, well, I don't want to speculate, but I think that they might have started a war to distract from Punch. Mm. Because if we continued with that, I think that there was going to be an uprising.
Yeah.
Bread and circuses.
Bread and circuses and monkeys. You know, monkeys often at circuses. So actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Actually, not anymore. Not anymore. My nephew.
When was the last circus you were at, Daisy?
Francis, I'm telling you, within the last 2 weeks, I FaceTime my best friend. I call her son my nephew. He is my nephew. I FaceTime my best friend. Of course, my nephew wants to speak to me directly. And she informs me that he's going to the circus later in the day. But they don't have animals anymore because of like animal cruelty. But then I did receive a video of him at the circus and he looked like he was having a great time. So maybe no animals necessary. My mom also told me, I conveyed this to my mom later, she said that she never took us to the circus, which is true. I did go to the circus, but it wasn't with my mom. Because when she went to the circus growing up, the sound of the whip that they used to tame the lions really scared her. And I wrote that detail down to use in a story because I thought that was very poetic.
Mm-hmm. Poignant.
Imagine being so affected by the sound of the lion's whip that you never take your children to the circus. It just echoes down the ages.
That's an incredible line.
Yeah.
Was that
Conrad and Mickey, if you're listening to this, you do not have my permission to use that in season 5 of Industry.
That's kind of what Train Dreams is about.
I wouldn't know. I haven't read it. Did you watch the movie, the adaptation?
No, I've not. I've only watched one movie this year. No, I've watched two movies this year. I watched Frankenstein in theaters.
I was like, wait, that's crazy. And then I remember it's only March. But actually,
I've only watched two movies, which is crazy because during the week of Christmas, a 7-day period, at the end of last year, I watched 12 movies. Brought to you by Letterboxd. I watched that, and then I watched this awful movie from I think 2011, a few weeks ago, Predators, which, you know, part of the Predator franchise. But the reason I wanted to watch it is because the cast is like Adrian Brody, Walton Goggins, Topher Grace, Danny Trejo. It was like all these names, and it was sort of this.
This was a recession. You know what? They all needed money in 2011.
They all needed money. Walton Goggins, especially, was like, what an oddity it was to see him there. This was before
same hairline.
Really knew about him. Actually, it was a little. His hair was a little. He had a slightly younger hairline. Mm. His hair was darker black, and it was much shorter. And he kind of had this real like sideshow villain character. He's playing like an escape. The premise of this movie is that. Like it starts with Adrian Brody just plummeting out of the sky above a jungle, and very quickly, like, you know, all these other characters plummet out, and you learn that, like, oh, they're all in some way like these cold-blooded killers, and they've been dropped here to be hunted by the predators. And Walton Goggins he's in his orange prison jumpsuit. He in particular has some really awful dialogue, but Brody is the star of this one.
I mean, he's the star of anything he appears in my opinion, my humble
including
opinion.
Including the Oscar speech 1 year ago. Wow.
Yeah.
I did love The Brutalist, though.
I've been thinking of rewatching it because Ben hasn't seen it. We've been going through a list of movies together that we both want to see. We saw Demon Lover.
Never heard of that.
You should watch it. There's this great moment where Gina Gershon appears in an I Love Gossip shirt. And Gina, I mean, look, if you're listening to this podcast, you can listen to a spoiler. Gina will be appearing on this season of The Desire Question.
Question.
To talk about her new book. So
season 2. When is season 2 coming out?
End of March, probably we'll start releasing episodes, but we're recording now.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Same host.
What? How could we do The Desire Question without Laura?
That's a great question. That's why I asked. I was teeing you up.
She's the greatest.
What did Nick Susi have to say about the 25 years of the iPod piece?
Oh, because he's on his music hardware beat?
Did he say, music is a fashion accessory? say the line, Nick.
He might have. So the piece was written by Molly Mary O'Brien, who is such a good, funny writer. And she's written for Dirt before. She wrote about, she was part of our Pure Moods package a couple years ago. And she also wrote about Imagine Dragons and this idea of rocktimism, which I love. She's great at like peppering in the personal anecdote. So the essay starts with her possibly illegal job at age 14 in the state of Vermont, using the proceeds to buy her first iPod. And just the way that the iPod shaped her relationship to music, where all of a sudden you could centralize it in one place, but it almost created more pressure for you to diversify your taste and make sure that like the spectrum of what you were collecting really represented who you were. And at the time there wasn't really a way to externalize that. So it was still pretty private and a private listening experience. And we haven't really achieved that again. There's pieces of that that have carried over into music streaming culture, but the intimacy of the relationship with your own iPod and your own library, I think, has been lost to the ages.
Certainly. I certainly have lost it.
Interesting thing about my iPod is when I got an iPod, my older brother said, I will just put my library on your iPod. I don't know how this conversation happened. Maybe he was like, I can get you started or whatever. So my iPod actually was not really my taste. It was my brother's taste. And I look back and I'm like, I never would have been like, I'm going to put Pearl Jam on here. I was like on the bus listening to Pearl Jam because that's like what my brother had. And like, who knows where he got it? I never even talked about it with him.
It's a band I never really listened to.
And I don't even think I knew what I was listening to, but it's not like I had songs were like a dollar each at that point. I didn't really have a ton of money to be spending on music. So like the amount of music that I paid for to download over the course of having my iPod was always dwarfed with the music that my brother had seeded onto my iPod. And so if I look back at my iPod, and I might still have vestiges of that library somewhere within my Apple Music library. I need to check. I'll check after this and let you know. It's such a weird representation. I don't feel like it really represents who I was at the time, but I also don't think that I understood myself or my taste in music at like a conscious level yet.
Certainly. I certainly did not at that point.
If anything, it shows that I've always just been the type of person that will like ingest what is put in front of me culturally and somehow integrate it into what I like. Like so much of my wardrobe is still like a shirt that a friend gave me that doesn't fit them anymore, or like a hand-me-down from my mom. And I think that like, if anything, that's sort of like my taste identity is integrating things that I have gotten more by chance than having sought them out.
That makes sense. I mean, I think of pivotal things in my life, pivotal books or music, and so much of it did come from other people. It wasn't really until, like with books, one of the most influential books for me as a child, the Redwall series, was really big for me. And my friend's mom, when I was a first grader, gave me one for my birthday. And that became so influential on me for the next like 10 years until high school. Or with music, my now brother-in-law, for my, I don't know, 12th or 13th birthday, something like that, gave me a like 1 terabyte external hard drive full of all his music. That was all the music that him and his friends had, you know, he's 10 years older, that him and his friends had collected over the years. And so that for a long time, like similar to you, was the vast bulk of my music library. It was like 500 gigabytes of music. The most impactful piece of that was Simon and Garfunkel. I listened to, there was like a bunch of Simon and Garfunkel on there. And soon enough, because I remember on iTunes, it would track how often you listen to a thing. Like every Simon and Garfunkel song had over 100 plays on it. Pretty quickly, huge for me. But yeah, I don't know. That's how taste is formed, right?
And it also makes you more conscious of the stuff that you definitely found and told everyone about. Like, yeah. I know I'm more conscious of the musicians in my library or stuff in my wardrobe, brands, whatever, where it's like, I was the one that found that. There was no intermediary. And that's like, I think that's important too. I think that also has a big role.
Because it tells you it, something that you feel is truly of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, like, I feel like it comes up a lot when people steal stuff from people that they dated. Like, I stole a lot of stuff, like, taste-wise, from people that I dated.
Well, you know what they say.
I stole Jeff Rickley from my ex-boyfriend. I didn't know who Jeff Rickley was. And now he was a huge fan of his music. And now Jeff and I are like personal friends.
Our friends, yeah. The taste, I can't say it. The taste keeps the score.
Sorry, Joe.
Sorry, Joe. We'll end it there.
Yeah, sure. See you next week.
This has been Tasteland. Thank you.